Today I'm joined once again by Marcia Reed, managing editor of geopoliticalmonitor.com, which is an excellent source of information on all matters influencing global geopolitics. The website provides news, situation reports, weekly forecasts, and lengthy background articles on important geopolitical issues. Marcia Reed, welcome back to the Corbett Report.
Hi, thanks for having me, James.
No problem. Well, Marcia, I'd like to get into a number of issues today, starting with the current meltdown of the American financial services sector, which I'm sure my listeners are familiar with by now. It seems to me this is a wild card on the geopolitical scene at the moment, with the large destabilization potential for all areas of the globe affected by the American empire. From your perspective, how do you see the current turmoil playing out on the global stage?
Well, it's really hard to predict anything too particular at the moment because, you know, everything is going back and forth with regards to the U.S. House of Representatives passing this bailout and people predicting a depression or a recession. But it's definitely some tough times ahead for the U.S. economy, and it's going to be really hard for the U.S. to really sort of flex its muscles economically around the globe when it has its this particular crisis to deal with. For example, just to sort of tie this into current dealings with Russia, since the U.S. was militarily spread thin, finances were the only way that the U.S. could deal with Russia with regards to its what it deemed was its incursion in Georgia. So going through the World Bank, the IMF, to freeze out Russian businesses and pretty much dealing with any other governments with regards to their finances. So this is going to be a really tough situation for the United States. In order to sort of enforce its global financial and economic order that's been in place since the end of World War II. With the Bretton Woods system established in the World Bank and the IMF, as I've mentioned, and the spreading and maintenance of these neoliberal economic policies, we're going to see this really shaken up now as, I guess, the American public is realizing how unstable and fundamentally flawed their own system is. So when their own people aren't really having faith in the system, it's sort of hard to expect others to have faith in the system. We've seen with Asian markets completely nosediving. We're also seeing in Europe and the UK the same thing happening with their banking system. And it's sort of spreading like a domino effect or sort of like this disease. Sort of reminds me of the late 90s with the Asian financial market crisis starting, I believe it was in Indonesia or Thailand, going all the way through Asia to Brazil and finally back to the United States. So we're going to see something like this again with the way the economy is so integrated, at least on the economic front. Militarily, I mean, the U.S. is spread so thin funding these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're costing about $12 billion a month. And they've projected that the war in Iraq will probably amount to about $3 trillion by 2017 or 2020, so in the next decade or so. So you can imagine with the U.S., the taxpayers funding a very unpopular war on terror and then having to deal with potentially bailing out the banking system in Wall Street, it's going to be really tough for the U.S. to get everything in order in terms of putting on this front and maintaining its financial, economic, and military order. So I think it's really interconnected, like foreign policy and economic policy are very interconnected. And so it's going to be really hard for the U.S. to deal with all of these within this time frame right now.
Well, that's a very good point that you raise. Of course, the entire international order has been structured around the American empire to a large extent based on American economic dominance. And talking about structures like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, these have been traditionally seen as extensions of American foreign policy in many ways because of the economic power that America holds. So you're saying basically if the crisis is great enough, it could even shake that order out of place so that America perhaps doesn't hold such a central position on the world stage?
Exactly. I mean, you said it quite well. I mean, these institutions are an extension of American hegemony. And so the World Bank, the IMF, does the bidding, essentially, of the United States. And if the U.S. economic system collapses, it's going to be a domino effect in terms of the actual structure of the international banking system collapsing. Now, what's going to replace it, I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's too early to talk about that yet. I mean, we have to see if there's still going to be an actual entire collapse of the system. But it's quite feasible that if this does collapse, I mean, we have a resurgent Russia, we have China. I'm not too sure right at this point in time which other country could sort of take the place of the United States economically. But it is quite a precarious situation for the United States with regards to its position financially. I mean, spread thin, so thin financially, economically, and militarily. But as to say who or what will replace this system if it in fact entirely collapses, it's too early at the moment to say quite yet what that would be.
It is a situation that's so dependent on a number of vagaries that obviously we can't predict. But assuming that in the short term nothing is resolved either way and the state of turmoil continues to exist similar to it the way it is now, how do you see that playing out in terms of the U.S. being also in a fairly unstable state insofar as there's an election coming up in November and American foreign policy and so many things hinge, of course, on that type of election? So do you see the American empire perhaps retreating into a carapace for the next couple of months while it sorts itself out internally? And if so, how does that affect situations like the U.S. Plot against Iran?
Right. Well, I think that the U.S., I mean, this is one of these situations where if anything can go wrong, everything seems to be going wrong at the moment. With they have an election to deal with. They have Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Russia. And I think this is sort of where the U.S. is at a brink where they sort of have to get, you know, their house in order. So this is definitely going to play out in the elections. We've already seen with regards to Americans are now looking at, for example, with McCain and Obama. Before this occurred, you could say that McCain had a good chance with regards to winning the presidential election. But I think now that with this economic crisis in place, we've seen McCain slipping in the polls as Obama's been a lot stronger on economics than McCain has. Now, if there were to have been, for example, a huge terrorist attack on U.S. soil, or say bin Laden was actually captured, then definitely you'd see this playing out in the Republicans' favor. But as it stands, this economic crisis is actually playing to the Democrats, and they can capitalize on this situation by saying that this has occurred under the Bush administration, under the Republicans, and this is a Republican problem, and that this is something the Democrats are best suited to solve. So with regards to affecting the actual presidential election, this is huge, I think. Also, with regards to foreign policy, the U.S. is in such a weak financial position, and also militarily, but at the same time, the U.S. isn't going to, you know, let that stop them from attempting to continue with business as usual. So I think that For example, with Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. is still going to be pushing forward with that. I think President Bush, realizing he has a few months left in his term, is really trying very hard to, for example, with the recent increase in airstrikes in Pakistan, which I guess we can get into a little bit more in a moment, just doing everything he can to show the American public that this war on terror is, in his view, still central and important to national security, and trying to achieve some kind of lasting legacy by having some high-value targets captured, obviously bin Laden and his second in command. So despite this financial crisis, I think that, as well, President Bush is still going to try and push forward with the war on terror. That's not going to stop for him. Also with Iran and having sanctions, stronger sanctions against Iran, and fears of their possible nuclear enrichment program, despite Russia deciding that sanctions at this time, or the kind of sanctions the U.S. wants, aren't appropriate. But President Bush, in the last few months of his term, is definitely going to do everything he can to go out on a high note, as high as it's possible for him regarding, despite the fact, that there have been a string of spectacular financial failures.
All right. Well, certainly the economic situation is an important one, and one that we'll keep our eye on as it continues to develop. But let's switch into the war on terror that you brought up there. And let's talk about Pakistan as an emerging theater of operations for the United States. And that can be garnered from a number of articles from the Geopolitical Monitor website in the last few weeks, including Pakistan military fires on NATO aircraft, Pakistan changes chief of spy agency, hot pursuit in Pakistan, U.S. denies helicopter incursion into Pakistan, Pakistani troops fire on U.S. soldiers. A whole spate of news stories from that region coming out in the last few weeks. I'm wondering, can you fill us in and give us some background as to what's happening in that region, maybe taking us back to last month and the ouster of Pervez Musharraf?
Right. Well, it's been quite a summer, I guess, and fall for Pakistan with the ousting of Musharraf. And we had a civilian coalition government tenuously formed to oust Musharraf and impeach him. And was highly unpopular with the Pakistani people, who saw him as a puppet of the U.S. government. And after that, we had this weak, very tenuous coalition which fell apart. And the United States, when they lost Musharraf, they were in this position wondering if they would still be able to maintain a good working relationship with Pakistan regarding their alliance in the war on terror. This alliance has started after 9/11, with Afghanistan being the front line for the war on terror and getting Pakistan on board after it had supported the Taliban for so long and finding a very close ally in Musharraf. But at the same time, Musharraf was, to a certain extent, for the United States, a bit of a liability in that towards the end, the United States felt Musharraf was also playing them off against the Taliban. And that ties into concerns about the ISI also having agents that were giving important intel to the Taliban and militants in the region and tipping them off to any NATO or U.S. incursions. But nonetheless, the relationship for the most part was a good one between the U.S. and Musharraf, and that garnered a lot of unpopularity with Pakistanis who did not appreciate the U.S. and it's the influence it wielded over their country. And so now we have a civilian government, which is about 6 months old, if you consider the coalition government, which still fell apart, and then the election of this President Zardari, the widower of Benazir Bhutto. And so they have this very precarious relationship now where the civilian government is facing tensions from the United States because they feel that they're not doing enough to combat militancy in the region, in particular the Northwest tribal region of Pakistan, which has been considered a sanctuary for militants and the Taliban, which are going across the border into Afghanistan to commit these attacks against NATO and U.S. troops. And also, the government is facing pressure from the people who are not happy with this alliance with the United States because they feel that the U.S. is sort of curtailing their sovereignty because U.S. troops, in return, have been going into the Pakistani border in these hot pursuits to capture these militants. And then there's the Pakistani military, which doesn't also appreciate the fact that the United States is taking a unilateral approach to dealing with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda as well. I forgot to mention Al-Qaeda. And so there's pressure from all different sides, the United States, the military, and the Pakistani people, with regards to who's doing enough or who's not doing enough to fight in this war on terror. And so it's been a really tough situation for the civilian government trying to find its footing. It also undermines the civilian government because the people feel that, as I've mentioned, they're just a puppet for the West and they're not really doing this on their own terms. To play devil's advocate, one could say the United States is justified in pressuring the Pakistani government and actually encroaching on its sovereignty by going into Pakistan and capturing these militants because the Pakistani government's not doing enough, and neither is their intelligence service, which has been questionable in the past few months with regards to possibly having agents, rogue agents, who are giving information to the militants. But the U.S. has to recognize the limits of their unilateral activities and that it's hurting not only Pakistan, but their working relationship that they have with Pakistan and their ability to fight this war on terror successfully. So it's one of these very murky situations. It's not clear cut. And I don't think the U.S. is going to let up anytime soon with regards to its unilateral activities like the airstrikes and these hot pursuits and renditions that they've been doing going from Afghanistan into Pakistan, especially now with the number of deaths increasing and with regards to casualties inflicted on NATO and U.S. troops, and the rise of the Taliban, which everyone, well, because they were distracted by Iraq, thought had been eradicated, they're realizing that this is, you know, serious and that attention needs to be put back to Afghanistan, so they're putting more pressure on Pakistan as a result of that. And Pakistan, likewise, is saying, well, we're doing all we can, we're going to fight this, but we have to do it on our own terms, and, you know, we're allies in this war on terror, but you have to respect our sovereignty. You can't cross into our borders and do as you like. You can't go into these villages and round up people that you suspect of being militants and, you know, committing airstrikes and so on and so forth. So this has been the situation occurring throughout the last few months, and it's continuing right now. So it's just another, you know, continuation in this war on terror, and it's finally coming to the forefront because Iraq has finally settled down comparatively, and the U.S. military is now focusing its efforts once again on the original front line and the true front line in the war on terror, which is Afghanistan.
Tell us more about the ISI tipping off or allegedly tipping off the Taliban to possible incursions by U.S. forces.
Right. Well, there was in July with India, there was a bombing of their embassy, Indian embassy in Kabul, and the U.S. had received some information that the ISI had actually provided information or was working with the Taliban to undermine the United States and also India, because there's been tensions between Pakistan and India since 1947, before that even, you could say, and with regards to which country would have more influence in Afghanistan, India or Pakistan. So there was that issue back in late July with the ISI tipping off or providing information to militants and providing them with information to conduct attacks against, with the embassy in Kabul and also against NATO troops and American troops in Afghanistan. Whether they're doing this to because they have they're anti-American or because it's just a matter of strategy in terms of gaining more influence in Afghanistan as compared to India, it remains to be seen. But definitely the United States has been very concerned for quite a while about the ISI playing both sides and providing information, and that a lot of these deaths that have been occurring, casualties, NATO and U.S. casualties, are because the ISI has been providing information to the Taliban, to militants, Al-Qaeda in the region. And, I mean, everyone's talked about the military in Pakistan and the ISI as being a state within a state, and that it doesn't really listen to the government, and the government has to do its bidding, the bidding of the ISI. So it's a very powerful body within Pakistan, and the U.S. is aware of that, and, you know, for a long time they've had their suspicions about them. Now, the fact that they have a new chief for the ISI could be Pakistan trying to placate the U.S. and sort of ease their fears that the ISI is out of their control. But it'll just be a matter of seeing what happens in the next few days and weeks, as with anything that happens geopolitically, and seeing, you know, what the ISI will do next with this under this new chief that they have. But definitely the ISI, the U.S. has considered it a bit of a liability and not to be trusted. But what can the U.S. expect when they, you know, engage in these alliances? I mean, it's a matter of prudence for them and in engaging in this alliance with Pakistan. And likewise with Pakistan, they've been given billions of dollars for allying themselves with the United States, one with Sharaf deciding to, you know, become an ally with the United States. So, you know, it's sort of one of these kind of strange bedfellows alliance, and no one can really be surprised when things like this actually do pop up. So that's been the situation with the ISI in Pakistan and its murky role in between the Taliban and militants and the U.S.
Well, that's some extremely interesting information, and I think the State Department's issues with the ISI has more to do with the State Department's relations to the CIA than it does to Pakistan's spy agency. And I encourage listeners at home to look up the former head of the ISI, General Mahmoud Ahmad, and where he was on September 11th, 2001, and cross-reference that to a story from the Wall Street Journal from October 2001 entitled "Our Friends the Pakistanis." But I'll leave you to do that research on your own. Moving on, so you don't see this as an escalation of the Pakistan-Afghan theater of operations for the war on terror so much as you see it as a shifting of focus from the Iraqi theater?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that there's a shift in from Iraq to Afghanistan, and there's also an escalation in terms of the U.S. talking about increasing troop presence, the increase in airstrikes, and the increase of cross-border activities between Pakistan and Afghanistan. I think that it's a combination of the two, and that the American public as well is now paying, I think because of the presidential election, the American public is paying a lot more attention to what's going on, and not that the U.S. military is heeding, or those who are planning these are heeding what the public's saying, but I think that as you know, we face, this is what, the seventh year now in the war on terror, I think that now that things have settled a bit in Iraq, the U.S. is able to have a freer hand, the military, have more of leeway in Afghanistan and sort of shifting its energy from Iraq to Afghanistan and trying to, and Bush as well, President Bush trying to wrap up this war on terror in his own presidential term. I mean, that's what he's been trying so hard for, to sort of validate his decision to start this global war on terror. But I think it's both a shift in focus and an increase in military activity.
All right, another important area on the geopolitical scene that we'll have to keep our eye on. Finally, Marcia, today I'd like to talk about an issue that we've talked about in the past in some of our previous interviews, which again are all available on CorbettReport.com for download. We've talked about the increasing tension between Russia and the U.S. in what some are calling a Cold War redux. And an interesting story popped up on September 8th on geopoliticalmonitor.com, Russia to send naval squadron to Venezuela, which says in part, quote, "Russia said Monday it will send a naval squadron and anti-submarine patrol planes to Venezuela this year for a joint military exercise in the Caribbean, a deployment that comes amid increasingly tense relations with the United States," end quote. This, I think, obviously is an escalation of the Cold War-type tensions, and I'm just wondering, how do you see this playing out in the future?
Yeah, well, this is, like you said, the Cold War redux. We've seen the fallout from the Georgian crisis playing itself out now, where the Russians are focusing on the Caribbean, and this is obviously because the United States is in their own backyard in Eastern Europe, pushing ahead with this missile defense system and continuing to insist that Georgia will receive NATO membership, also going to the Ukraine and Lithuania for support, and so sort of effectively continuing this cordon sanitaire. So Russia has now taken the game to the U.S. on their backyard in the Caribbean, and they conducted a military exercise, I think it was this past weekend, with Venezuela in the Caribbean. Now, the Russians said that they'd planned this from July before the Georgian crisis escalated, or actually occurred, and so that this is not a result of the Georgian crisis. However, in light of the crisis, the Russians must realize that the U.S. is going to respond to this differently and not be very welcoming of Russian warships conducting naval exercises pretty much in its backyard or on its doorstep. So I think the Russians, knowing this, it's sort of like the proverbial middle finger, I guess, to the United States by continuing to continue this relationship with in the Caribbean with Venezuela and with Cuba and with other Latin American countries that have been very anti-American, Nicaragua and Ecuador and Bolivia as well. And Russia has also dealt with Venezuela in terms of bilaterally with energy deals, and has actually suggested or considered developing nuclear program, a peaceful nuclear program with Venezuela, but nonetheless a nuclear program, and Washington's obviously not going to be pleased with that. So militarily, conducting naval exercises, also I think it was a $10 billion deal that Russia had agreed to, or at least over the years it's been amounted to that, but they have agreed with Venezuela to this multi-billion dollar deal in terms of arms deals. So that'll be rearming Venezuela militarily, and then also energy deals with Venezuela. The United States is not going to be pleased with that. But as I mentioned earlier, the United States is spread thin, and they have Iraq, not so much now, but also Afghanistan to deal with, this economic crisis, presidential election, and trying to maintain its global and military order overall. And I don't know how easy it's going to be for the United States to really tell Russia to stop what they're doing and, you know, cease and desist. Russia knows this, and this is why they've capitalized on this opportunity to conduct, or at least cement, bilateral relations with these Latin American countries, these socialist and left-leaning Latin American countries. And I think it's interesting that, you know, Russia, it's sort of like everything lined up perfectly for them, whereas everything's falling apart for the United States. This is Russia's moment to shine, and everything seems to be lining up perfectly, with Georgia deciding to, you know, act when it did, not having the full backing of the West, at least militarily, and also taking advantage of the U.S.'s weak economic and military position. So the United States, the only thing I can see them really doing, because they're not going to be able to actually do anything militarily, that would be suicide, would be to just press ahead with gaining and cementing alliances in Eastern Europe. And also, the U.S. has actually increased a lot of its weapons deals. There was an article on the website that talked about the U.S., I think it's about $32 billion, up from $12 billion in arms deals to various countries, a lot of them new countries that they haven't had arms deals, weapons deals with before. So the United States is going to do anything it can financially, despite the fact that it has this crisis, to sort of cement alliances and curb a resurgent Russia, as well as North Korea and Iran, as usual. But that's all the U.S. really can do, is just push its case in Eastern Europe. And it's going to just continue, I think. Hopefully cool heads will prevail, and we're not going to see anyone do anything insane, like actually coming to direct conflict. But there's definitely going to be these proxy battles playing themselves out, whether it's financially or militarily, with the Russians giving more money to Latin America and the United States giving more money to Georgia or the Ukraine or Lithuania and so on. So it's going to be back and forth. And like I've mentioned, I keep mentioning the presidential election, but I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens after November 4th. If the Americans choose McCain, business as usual. If the Americans choose Obama, I'd like to think that we're going to see diplomacy, and we're going to see a scaling back of these tensions. But then it also remains to be seen how the Russians will respond, too. They may not care who's elected, and they want to continue with this antagonistic relationship.
Absolutely. Well, some excellent analysis, as always, and a lot of information to digest. Let's stop there. But before we go, let's talk a little bit about Geopolitical Monitor. For people who are listening maybe for the first time, could you explain a little bit about the website?
Sure. Geopolitical Monitor is, like I said, a really great website. Open source intelligence. We talk about and discuss and analyze news stories that are not in the mainstream, but the mainstream media doesn't really want to touch. And we just discuss a lot of things that are going on politically and militarily around the world that you won't really see in the mainstream media. And there is no bias. We're not here to, you know, paint a one-sided picture. We're just talking about the news as it occurs, and without the spin, because we see a lot of that in the media, a lot of spin on news stories, but we're just trying to present what's going on and sort of letting everybody know the underlying or background to a lot of these stories, how they came to be, where they're going. So we have forecasting as well as backgrounders. So it's a really great website that encompasses a lot of different aspects geopolitically. I think it's really important, and it's a really great site, lots of information. We have new writers coming in, so there'll be more interesting articles in the future as well.
And tell us about subscription.
For those, we have a subscription base where you can subscribe monthly or yearly to the website, and you can gain access to our audio, our articles as well. So while a lot of the content is free, if you subscribe, you can gain access to our other articles that have audio as well. So you can listen to our forecasts and our backgrounders, and I would really recommend a subscription to this site. There's a lot of really great information, a lot of things that are covered that you really won't find in the mainstream, or it'll be very hard to find. So sort of we do that work for you, and we find all these great stories and articles, events that are going on, and analyze, forecast. So a subscription is really something that people should consider with this website.
All right, an excellent website and some excellent analysis, as always. Marcia Reed, thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Thanks for having me once again.